It's the beginning of the year, a year where, after slimming down, getting rid of what I don't need, and refocusing my priorities, it's time to start thinking about what's next, what's amazing to do, and how to do it all right. This is Jason Scott, and you're listening to the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast, a podcast about stories, technology, and debt. Thanks to Jeff Atwood, Daniel Boyd, and the hundreds of other supporters who help bring this podcast to life. I'm back in the studio again. It's 2018. I have been doing 14 episodes of this podcast, and I'm about to start my 15th, and I am now doing my 15th. And it's really now a matter about understanding the process, making it smooth as possible, getting it to sound as good as it can, and getting it out as efficiently as possible so that there's no situation where I dread the project or try to get away from it. This is the biggest problem with projects that have an ongoing schedule. That's commitment and consistency. People just aren't really built to do a certain thing over and over again without feeling the need to do variations, or maybe not work as hard on it, or get away from it by coming up with a whole range of excuses. And I don't want to do that. I like doing this podcast. I like talking to people, and it's something that, because I've chosen to do a few less presentations and because I don't always get the opportunity to meet people, it's something I really need in my life. So the podcast, as it goes on, becomes a situation where I have to think about, where am I spending the most time? Right now, I spend the most time in editing. I take what I record in the studio, which has multiple takes of the same idea or phrasing, and then choosing which one wins. I also get rid of weird pauses or where I breathe funny or all the sorts of little mistakes a person can make when they're just extemporaneously talking into a microphone. I then put it together, and then I upload it through Libsyn and the Patreon page, and then let it syndicate outward. The easiest part, believe it or not, is the writing, because these are things that I care about and I've thought a lot about, and it's no big deal for me to be able to talk about them. That's the easy part. Somewhere in the middle is just allocating the time and making sure that I can give an hour or two to recording the main podcast and then a couple hours to edit it. If I think I can get it down further, I will, but up to now, it's a relatively manageable amount of time. I'm not really concerned about not having the time. It's all about finding a place in there to make it interesting without going off the rails. Consistency and following through actually came to the forefront for me recently because of a pretty amazing story out in Belgium. A member of an Amiga cracking group called Bamiga Sector 1 turned out to have taken all of the floppy disks that they had collected over the years when they were a cracking group and put them into their attic. This worked out to 80 boxes of Amiga floppies, which is something like 10,000 floppies. And a person named Simon V has gone into their attic, taken out these 80 boxes, and he and another volunteer are going through them and just imaging all the floppies. This got a lot of attention, and people brought it to my attention, and so I'm mirroring it for them. Although I rush to stress that I am not doing much of anything. I'm just cataloging what comes in into an item on the Internet Archive just to ensure there's one more mirror of it. But what's interesting about dealing with 10,000 of something is that there's an initial blush, a real fascination with the fact that you've happened upon a treasure trove. And that's what the people are calling it, a treasure trove. And you think about how amazing it's going to be, that all of it is going to end up somewhere, whether it be online or a museum or with a group. And then you begin the process. And the process is tedious, especially if you insist on doing it linearly. You start out with the first disk. You go through all of the disks in the box. Along the way, disks fail. Things fail to make any sense. The labeling is wrong. You wonder if you should be coming up with some sort of file convention. Should you be doing some sort of evaluation of each image as you do it? And suddenly the project is not quite so fun. You end up with having to still move through these 10,000 items, but it is not out of the realm of possibility that by the end of the process, you hate how you started the process. But that's the difference between somebody who is committed to a project and somebody who is fascinated by a project. If you're fascinated, the fascination wears off. Fascination is just a brand new perspective on something. It's obsessively moving through each item with the same level of clarity that kind of separates people and separates types and actually shows you who cares about what. Now, I have a whole range of tricks that I've come up with over the years for dealing with large projects. Multiple times in the last couple of years, I've put my process up on streaming services like Twitch or YouTube, where I will actually archive a whole variety of material or edit a whole bunch of material, and then I'll be sharing it live and answering questions. And I think for people who could actually watch somebody else accomplish something, they always have, you know, the general, like, what's Internet Archive kind of questions and what's your deal and what do you use? But people also try to kind of ride the wave of what's coming in. I mean, a lot of this is very assembly line. Human beings were not designed for assembly lines. Assembly lines were machines demanding that people become a certain way for the benefit of the process itself. As it turns out, I like repetitive action. Not sure where that came from. You know, I've tried to think back to why, but maybe part of it was being more of a solitary kid. Perhaps I like working through something from the beginning to the end simply because it was me working at my own pace. But however that is, I absolutely love being given a list and then being told this process has to be done to each item. And then when you get to the end, you are done. And however many days it takes to do it. So back to Bemiga Sector 1. The fact is that pretty much everything in this collection, we think, will be out there already. I mean, Bemiga Sector 1 traded with other groups. The items that they traded, which were primarily games and Amiga programs, they got out into all of the usual distribution locations, and they ended up online, and people could download them pretty easily. And there's been an extreme active classification group out there, TOSEC, as well as other groups that have kind of gone through the Amiga floppy world and come up with pretty much every major release. So there's not much belief that what's going to be in the 10,000 floppies is going to be brand new. But what it does do is provide provenance. Now, provenance is something that I had to learn about on the fly as I became an archivist. And what it basically consists of is the pedigree or the steps or the known documented situation where you know where a piece of data or an artifact came from. So say you have two boxes of floppies. It helps a lot to know that this box of floppies came from this person who got it from this person who was the original person who made the floppies. And then to know that the other box is something that the original person gave to another person. And it turns out that even though it's got the same origin, it was done under different conditions, and that scholars and people who are trying to understand what they're looking at, they live off of provenance. It's also got a slight legal aspect. It's nice to know that your paintings weren't stolen. Your artifacts were not lifted out in the dead of night on a ship out of Egypt. It's good to know where the things come from when people later demand to know, where is this from, and should we be giving it back? Obviously, some areas care about this a lot more than others, and digital material has never really had the same level of weight applied to it, mostly because I don't think there's an administrative apparatus that's had to live through it. It's primarily been volunteer groups and the work therein that causes these floppy disk images to exist, and so they haven't gone crazy with tracing back the origin and the pedigree of each single floppy. What this Bemiga Sector 1 collection does is show a 25-year gap in the movement of these floppy disk images. In other words, you're able to look at this particular floppy, and you can say, I know this was in an attic in Belgium for 25 years. That means that any manipulations, any modifications, anything people are doing to discs in the previous, you know, couple of decades didn't happen to these. So what does that mean? Well, here's some theories. You can find out when people made changes to programs to take credit for it. You can find modifications in phone numbers or modifications in text files. You can find where somebody over the years had a bad sector, and that bad sector has now been duplicated multiple times. You know, there's a famous problem with Oregon Trail, and I'm part of the problem, which is there's somewhere along Oregon Trail's provenance that people ended up changing the name. And so it says, here lies cheese and pepperoni, and it's spelled wrong. But it's in the canonical collection of Oregon Trail that a lot of people play on the Internet Archive and which gets passed around. You know, in other words, there's this one kid who made one weird modification, and it turns out he has unwittingly joined immortality, and millions of people have played with cheese and pepperoni being in their lives. It gets weirder. There are these high score tables that come in some Apple II floppies, and depending on the program, either you can write to that high score or it gets destroyed each time you restart the game. A lot of games wanted to take advantage of the Apple II and be able to make it that you playing your arcade game at home would have your high score saved, and so every time you booted it up, there you were, an accomplishment that would stick around. The Cracker 4AM has been working extensively with a whole variety of original Apple II floppy images, trying to bring them back and have the provenance be from the original magnetic media that was made by the company professionally anywhere between 20, 30, and 40 years ago, so that we know what the game looked like, and we know how this educational software was built, and we know that every bit on there is something that hasn't been manipulated in the decades hence. So there's a program called Rescue Raiders, and it's a straightforward arcade game. But this game has a high score table, and the high score table has these names on it that are defaults. And the default names are Wild Woodsy, Nargo Danbra, Lovely Linda, Precious Pamela, Fearless Fred. You can't really tell if these are the original names or these are something somebody added later as a joke, except we're still living in an era that people involved with these programs are still alive and are still able to weigh in, and Brenda Romero, who is a wonderful game maker and historian and person who played a big part in Surtek software and other software houses over the years, she weighed in and mentioned that Nargo Danbra is a modification of her name Brenda Garno, which was her maiden name. So that's actually her, probably from when she was a playtester on Rescue Raiders. And so we know through this discussion that this is probably the original floppy image. But it actually can get even weirder. So I was contacted by a concerned user who was worried that one of the seminal RPGs, Might and Magic, was not being properly archived, because whatever images they were looking at, there were missing characters in the roster, the default roster when you started the game up, and they thought that was an indication that other major modifications had been done. So 4AM imaged one of the original Might and Magic floppies and discovered that there was a default party that we had all thought was completely fake. The original party of Might and Magic is actually an incredibly stupid roster of names. It's Crag the Hack, Sir Galand, Xenon 3, Swifty Sarg, Serena, and Wiz with two Z's, Bane, Wizbane. And these characters are the defaults that come with Might and Magic, and over the years, people would image Might and Magic, see the broken names, and say, oh, well, somebody obviously played with this disc before I got to it. I'll take those names out. It was just a matter of having enough focus to figure out that that particular disc's provenance was valid, and the things we were seeing were valid. Somewhere in here, it starts to become obvious that this doesn't scale. There's no way you can take every individual Apple II floppy or Amiga floppy, put it on a table surrounded by experts in the field, and have all of them weigh in and agree as some sort of conference as to the actual history, provenance, meaning, and context of that floppy. It's just asking too much. People don't have that level of energy. I've seen podcasts where people have played through almost all or all of the Nintendo cartridges. I've certainly seen cases where people have been able to do amazing lists that go on for reams and days, and you just don't even know where there could possibly be more items to come. But even those people will hit a wall. They'll find that some people are gone or don't want to be interviewed, and so as a result, their list is incomplete. Believe me, I'm somebody who loves annotation. I love reading annotated works. There's some really well-made pieces out there where people take original literary works and then help you understand the context and the meaning for what's being described in the books. I've read the annotated Hobbit, for example, and there's things in there I never would have understood without the person telling me that, oh, this was inspired by a certain story, or this is a literary reference, or this is a linguistic reference. You know, I just need this to understand the book fully. I can enjoy it otherwise, but to really understand it, I need that annotation. An example that I'll give people a lot is the one about Sherlock Holmes. Now, the Sherlock Holmes stories are enjoyable. You don't need to know a lot, and that's why they're classics. You could read a Sherlock Holmes story and respond to it on a pure fiction level as a story that has a beginning and a middle and an end with fascinating characters. But there's aspects of the life that Sherlock Holmes lives that just simply don't translate anymore. Sherlock Holmes would get the mail and read something from somebody and respond to it, and then a short while later, they would get a response again. And I didn't really understand that in the time of Sherlock Holmes, the mail in some parts of London would come 8 or 12 times a day. I mean, every hour there would be mail pickup and mail drop off because that was email. I mean, your email was you would write a letter out, leave it in your post box, it would get picked up, and then the person would read what you said, respond to it, leave it back out on their post box, and it would be sent over to you again. This really happened. I don't think most people even have a need to know that, but the Sherlock Holmes stories depend on that sort of facility existing. But the enjoyment of the writing does not require you to notice that's what's going on. So back to process. It's this fact that every single item has some sort of story that compels people like me to go through all of the items that come before us and in some way and to some level get them up for others to understand and enjoy and perhaps network with folks who love doing annotation, who love tracking down context, who love finding out what the story was behind one particular item all the way through, and if they're particularly masterful or if they're particularly wide-read, be able to find the greater universal meaning of this program, of this floppy, of this group, of this cracker. There's a site called Demo Zoo, and what was fun about the Bamiga Sector 1 project is that I was able to go to this site, and what the researcher had done was go through the cracking screens of Bamiga Sector 1, as well as references in different disc magazines of the time, and be able to come up with a relatively good who's who quality level history of the group, to say that it was formed in this year and it thrived for a couple years. It went from this many members to this many members, and then it kind of fades out here, and then everyone retires. I was able to use that and put it into the entry for the Bamiga Sector 1 collection. And in doing so, maybe somebody down the line will use that when they try to understand some of the Amiga programs that are in this collection. I mean, if I had to define the thing that really is maybe not understood by folks when they get involved in large-scale projects like this, is the person who will really tie the room together may not be born yet. They may have tools that we could just dream of, an avatar or an AI that, given some of the rule sets, will start to derive connections and meaning, right? People having names that transferred from working on this program to another, and the AI is able to not just figure that out, but figure out that there's a coding style and how these things are put together, and be able to majestically derive a meaning in thousands and thousands of pieces of software to understand where the human race went wrong, where the human race went right, and please get back into your sleeping pods, you miserable humans. I don't know. But it's the fact that the project is not just the people involved in it now, but the people who will take up the gauntlet in years hence, that really is the magic of process. Let's be clear. As far as the archiving world goes, I am a dilettante. A newbie, an outsider, a person on the street, just stumbling along in his untrained way to figure out where things are and where they go. But I've been doing this in some way for most of my life. When I ran a text file BBS in my teens, I had to come up with a classification system. And I just kind of did it by osmosis. I didn't talk to anybody. And I created this naming convention of extensions. And this is before extensions had teeth. But I would say .hac was hacking, .phk was freaking. And looking back, I can't believe a 14-year-old felt both the need and went through with a classification system for text files. But I still use it to this day. Textfiles.com has it all over. And this classification system was then applied to 50,000 text files, each of which I wrote a one-line description of, again, when I was 16. I don't know how I ever got a tan. But the textfiles.com descriptions are now used by many others to find all sorts of material on textfiles.com that perhaps wouldn't have a context, that perhaps wouldn't be found. I recently looked over the web stats of textfiles.com. It's been a while. I let it go. I don't always check the site. And on the whole, something like a couple hundred thousand people visit the website every month, and they get hung up on one particular file. You know, there's one or two files that, for whatever reason, get mentioned in Reddit, and suddenly the thing's gotten 50,000 people reading it, and then it disappears, and on a regular day, it's a few thousand people. But the fact is that these files are still playing a part in people's lives, I think, because I was committed in my youth to describing them all as well or as poorly as I could, and then knowing that maybe someday somebody else will do something with it. And it turns out people have. There's a worldwide network out there that has now ingested the text files, turned them into something even more, given them context I never could have dreamed of, and brought to the world and brought out a value that even a teenager could never really truly have dreamed would go as far as it has. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to James Bakoyanu, Sam Johnston, and the hundreds of other Patreon supporters who help make this podcast come to life. Talk to you next week.